Technicians of Spaceship Earth, welcome to Hawk Binge, your guide to the days of the underground, radical escapism in the age of paranoia.
Yes, the voice of Mr. Joe Banks himself welcoming you all to a very, very special episode of Hawk Binge, because we have reached, with PXR5, the end of Hawkwind studio releases in the 1970s, which also means the end of season one of Hawk Binge, as we've separated our seasons by decades, the end of that record deal, the end of that lineup, seemingly the end of everything. So we wanted to take this opportunity to really recap the 1970s, see where Matt stands on the whole 1970s deal, and who better to welcome in as a guest for this particular episode than the man who quite literally wrote the book on Hawkwind in the 1970s, Mr. Joe Banks. And you're not too mentally scarred from your first appearance on Hawk Binge then, Joe?
No, I survived it and I've come back for some more. So thank you very much, guys, for welcoming me back.
Outstanding. Thanks for being here. And also, I am actually in the room with Matt in New York, the first time we've seen each other in the flesh for about 2 years, and the first time we've seen each other since we started Hawk Binge. How are you doing, Matt?
I'm doing very well, Andy. It's nice to actually be able to see you in 3D and not through a computer screen like normal.
Exactly that. So we've got a few things that we're going to go over today. There is some actual music that is not part of the studio releases of the 1970s. And we've all selected some tracks to talk about because we don't let Matt listen to the bonus material on any of the albums so that he gets the original album experience. And also, I recently discovered that the bonus tracks on Levitation are actually Hawklord's recordings from just before that particular version of the band ceased to exist, which makes them 1970s tracks. We've got a bit of that to go through. Joe is exercising his right to reply to Matt's most dissed tracks of our 1970s run. That would be really interesting and see whether Matt stands by some of his quite egregious comments of the time. And we'll see whether Joe can maintain his calm with his righteous fury as that debate takes place. And obviously, we will be chatting about Hawkwind in the 1970s and Joe and Joe's book before finally taking a little bit of a look forward through the lens of Live 79 and what that tells us about Hawkwind yet to come. So I said we'd start off with some tracks. We've all picked three bonus or unreleased tracks from various Hawkwind periods during the 1970s. And we thought we'd run through those. And Joe, as guest, you have first pick. What are you bringing to the table?
So the first track I'm bringing is a track which is called Over the Top, or rather has become known as Over the Top, because it's not a song as such. It's actually an improvisation. And this is from the one-off Sonic Assassins gig that was held at the end of 1977 in Barnstable, which is near to where Dave Brock lives or was living at the time. And it's also near to where Robert Calvert was living at the time. It was very unusual because usually there's a Hawkwind Christmas tour, but there wasn't in 77. And so anyway, both of these guys were back near Barnstable and they decided to stage, or certainly Brock decided to stage this gig under the name of the Sonic Assassins. So it was him and Calvert, and it was three members of a local band who they had played with quite a bit called ARC. So this track is, it sounds like an amazing gig. Calvert was really, really off on one, I believe is the technical description. All around this kind of period, there'd been the infamous Paris incident just a couple of months earlier where basically the rest of the band had ran out on him. They got in a car and driven to the airport without him after he'd had a bit of a meltdown on tour, and he was still probably not in the best place. But Brock had persuaded him to do this gig. And the actual track, just to explain where it first appeared on the first Weird tape, which is tapes that Dave Brock started putting out from 1980 onwards. It was also first released on vinyl by Flickknife in 1981, I think. And anyway, so as I said, this isn't really a kind of song as such. You can hear some chat from Calvert, very funny stuff about how heavy the mic stands are. And he says, "Hey, Dave, these mic stands, they're really heavy. So are you." And that bit always absolutely kills me. It's like, particularly as he says it in, it's like pre-Nigel Tufnell, but it's exactly that kind of accent. So it sounds like a Spinal Tap moment. But anyway, he clearly thinks, he starts talking and he thinks that they're about to go into Master of the Universe. I assume that was what was on the set list. But They don't. The keyboard improvisation in the background just keeps on going. So Calvert starts kind of improvising over the top of this. And what he actually does is he reads the words to the Awakening, which is one of the poems from Space Ritual. But then he starts getting into a different train of thought. And apparently Harvey Bainbridge had been to see Robert the night before the gig to persuade him to do it, because even right up until the last minute, he was saying he wasn't going to do it. And when Harvey arrived at his house, he was dressed in a full First World War army outfit. And so he'd clearly been reading a lot about the First World War at the time. This was on his mind. And anyway, this is what he starts talking about in the song. And I think, as I say in the book, it's an incredible insight into kind of how Calvert's mind worked and how quick he was, like a real quicksilver thought processes. But it's also the sense of this all channels being open. You know, he doesn't kind of restrain himself. He lets the words come out of him, and he builds up this incredible stream of consciousness and a head of steam, you know, about the First World War, and kind of is shouting about giving me a white feather at the end, you know, saying that this is better than going to war and dying. And it's just one of those tracks that's just never, ever fails to kind of amaze me when I hear it, the kind of power of his words. And the actual music itself is also worth commenting on, because as it develops, it sounds incredibly like trance techno from like 15 years later. And that in itself is kind of really interesting. But anyway, yeah, it's a fantastic track. If for whatever reason you haven't heard this track, you absolutely must, particularly if you're a Calvert fan. It's extraordinary.
When I first listened to it, I definitely thought this is a great name for the track. It certainly does go over the top, both from a World War One trench point of view, but also just from a pure state of mind point of view.
I hadn't heard it. And the reason I hadn't heard it was because there's an early Motorhead track called Over the Top. And I'd always just assumed that this was a Hawkwind version of it, like the track Motorhead. So I put on the headphones expecting to hear that. And then I heard what this track actually is. Calvert's rather inspired leaping from point to point, line to line, reminds me of how now when you get the freestyle rappers, and some of them are absolutely brilliant at making these connections and going from line to line to line. Now, that's really what Calvert was doing. It's amazing when he does jump from his astral cosmic journey into the trenches of World War One. You can definitely see that something has just snapped. He's just jumped from one to the other. But yeah, phenomenal piece of improvisation for sure. And definitely great story behind it that you've told. Matt, what have you got?
Following up from that, mine's going to seem a little anticlimactic. It's Robot from PXR5. I found an unreleased version of it. I kind of spoiler alerted the fact that Robot would be part of this when we talked about the previous podcast, because I was really torn between whether or not Robot, High Rise, or Uncle Sam's on Mars was going to make the playlists. And unfortunately, Robot didn't make the cut because of what we talked about. But one of the reasons why I was kind of okay with dropping Robot from the playlists was that I know we were going to do this, and I knew that Robot was a B-side for Selection, where High Rise and Uncle Sam's on Mars was not. So I am leading with what I said I would lead with, which is Robot, a track which I absolutely loved when I heard it. PXR5 was just full of classic Hawkwind stories, and Robot being a fantastic observation of the kind of dystopian cyberpunk stories which were starting to arise in popular sci-fi, but also then the idea of likening it to someone trapped in a Ford-style assembly line system, like the Microman, that idea of someone who is doing a task but not really knowing why, and therefore becomes resigned to it, and it means that their soul isn't in it, their heart isn't in it, the idea that someone needs to understand and care about what they're doing in order to be a fulfilled person, otherwise you may well be an automaton. It felt like a lot of ideas that Hawkwind had been talking around in the previous albums finally came to fruition in one story which you could just grab hold of. So I'm very glad that there was a bonus track version of this that I was able to keep for Hawk Binge posterity.
I absolutely love Robot. It really is one of my favorite Calvert tracks. But I have to say that the version that I like the best is the one that is on the first Friends and Relations album, which I think was recorded in Croydon, on the same tour as the version that you get on PXR5. But there's something particularly wild about that version, particularly Simon House's incredible violin solo, which is put through all of those effects and is just out of this world. So absolutely love that track.
One to check out for you for sure, version of that. I'd not really listen to this. I find on most of the extended versions of albums, when they're kind of loads of demo version of this, unfinished version of that, I tend not to really bother with them because I always assume that they are not going to be as good as the thing that the band selected to be the canon version of the track. So when I listened to these, I was actually quite surprised. I really like this version of Robot. I like the kind of high-pitched harmony going on in the background. I was surprised when it came in, but I really liked it. And I thought there was more of a groove to this version of the track. The one on the album, I understand why it's the one they picked for the studio album. The Robot, it has more of a staccato vibe to it. But this one has quite a nice kind of rolling feel to it. And it's a good energy. So, yeah. A nice one. Nice one for sure. My first track to bring to the table, talking of that Friends and Relations album, Joe, I bought that album at the World Science Fiction Convention in Brighton, which I think was 1989. And it was on sale there because Michael Moorcock was there signing. So I bought it and he signed it. On that album is Valium 10. And I played the whole album and then I just replayed Valium 10 over and over and over. And still, it's just a kind of a joyful thing to me. There's no in-depth story behind it like there is with Over the Top or like there is with Robot. There's nothing particularly philosophical going on. It's just a really good vibe. I love the keyboard sound. And it's just 7 minutes of bounce to me. I'm a huge fan of Valium 10. And that said, it genuinely does not fit on any studio album. So it's right that it's a non-album track.
It's odd because in a way it's classic Hawkwind. It's got all of the amazing kind of space sounds as well as the groove. But at the same time, it doesn't really fit into the timeline. And what is interesting, of course, is that this was one of the tracks that was produced at the start of 79 when they were still the Hawklords and Robert Calvert had left. Martin Griffin had left as well, but Brock Bainbridge and Steve Swindles were still there. And this is really driven by Steve Swindle's organ. It's just amazing cosmic northern soul is how I refer to it as. And it just gives you an insight into if they'd have kept on going in that direction, if Steve Swindles hadn't left. I mean, this was around the time when they were asking, or certainly Dave Brock was asking Steve Swindles whether he would become Hawkwind's frontman, because, you know, Swindles had already done, you know, like a solo album and was obviously a singer and an artist in his own right. And I think he certainly gave it some thought, but then eventually left to do his own thing. But this is almost like a kind of glimpse into what could have been, I think, and just a marvelous track.
Yeah, very much so. I like that description of a kind of cosmic northern soul record. That's beautifully put. And Joe, for your next track, you've gone with another Hawklords recording.
Another Hawklords recording and another one of Friends and Relations Volume 1. I should say that I have a very special relationship with that record because I believe it's the first Hawkwind vinyl I ever bought. I think I bought it in 82, pretty much when it came out. And, you know, I was intrigued by all these different iterations, Hawkwind, Hawklords, Sonic Assassins. And it's also got, as you say, Michael Moorcock and Inner City Unit on it as well. So this was probably the first track that I heard on a Hawkwind album that I owned myself. It starts with this version of Who's Gonna Win the War. And people are probably most familiar with the Levitation version from when Hugh Lloyd Langdon had rejoined the band and Ginger Baker was in the band, which is also, it's a good version, but it's comparatively mellow compared to this first Hawklords version, which is just a blitzkrieg of sound. You know, it's a real barrage at the start. And then it kind of drops down into these incredibly menacing verses. As I said, I got it in 82 and paranoia about nuclear war and all the rest of it was absolutely at its height. And this is one of the first songs from that kind of era that really tapped into that. And it still gives me a bit of a chill listening to this version, particularly against Steve Swindle's keyboards. Just wonderfully cold and sparse. And it's got this frightening kind of almost dead feel to it, except it's got this, you know, it's got the really rousing chorus as well. This is definitely for me one of Hawkwind's most frightening songs and a good Brock lyric as well. Just a wonderful song and for me kind of superior to the Levitation version.
I'd not heard this version and on Levitation, obviously, I'm very used to that particular version of it. And this one sounds to me like the way it should be played. There's more urgency in Brock's voice, which seems to me to fit the mood of the words. So, yeah, I would agree. I think that's a sound choice. Matt's second pick is the track with no name to call its own.
A minor jam session, which was recommended to me I think a couple of times during the podcast correspondence that we have with people, I think a few people tweeted to you that I would probably enjoy this track. And I hope those people are very happy to know that I did. When I was going through all the bonus tracks that Spotify had to offer, I know that I may well have missed one or two of the extensive hidden discography that Hawkins seemed to have all over the place. But the Minor Jam session spoke to me just because it had, again, a very pure distillation of part of what Hawkwind does that I really get on with. For me, it feels a little bit like the sonic equivalent of a water droplet in zero gravity, wherein it's always moving a little bit, but it's always coming back to its center of gravity. But when it does so, even the act of doing that forces parts of it to ripple and split off. It never shatters, you know, it never goes into droplets, but it always just has this kind of undulation to it, you know, that kind of surface cohesion the water has. And I feel like their jam sessions, when they do them right, feel like that to me. They go in different places, but they are able to pull each other back in a kind of like sonic tidal way. And for me, a Minor Jam session pretty much hits everything that I want them to hit in one of their jam sessions. It doesn't go off the rails. It goes on for a decent amount of time, which I also really like, because proggy experimentation, I feel like, should be a good 10 to 15 minutes. It just feels like that's the right amount of time for it to breathe. And I feel like this starts nicely, it wanders about, but it brings itself together in a very satisfying way. Because it's all sonics, it's difficult to really, again, describe it, which is why I kind of like this water droplet analogy, because it's a distillation of the things which I've enjoyed in the albums, but just taken out separately as its own little bit. And if anyone ever came to me and said, hey, Matt, can you explain why you like certain parts of Hawkwind? I could literally grab this track, throw it at them and say, if you like this, they always come back to this despite wherever they go. And it's the home that I like and feel comfortable with and enjoy. And it's always nice to know that however far I let them go, they will always at some point in an album find their way home. And that is the thing which I, at least in the 70s, have enjoyed listening for. And I think quite a lot of the tracks which probably have made it to the master playlist have been tracks where I'm like, oh, that's home for me. Even things like when we've talked about things like Warrior on the Edge of Time, there was things like that was Spiral Galaxy, was it? That one? Yeah, you know, that for me was like the track where I'm like, oh, they've come home just to that little bit that I like, even though they've gone and talked about Magnu horses and people on the edge of space and all this kind of stuff. Like, there's the one track where they're like, we're going to do this. And I always enjoy that. So, yeah, to find that again in a B-side and again, in a way, an almost more pure version of it than a lot of other versions I've heard was a great find. So thank you to everyone who recommended that. That is my select for the Best of the Bonuses part two.
Nice. And Joe, I suppose a rolling jam like that kind of goes right back to the early days of the formation of the band.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's, you know, basically was their raison d'etre. That's what they used to do, you know, right in the early days, just kind of extemporizing around simple themes and seeing how far it would go. From Matt's description, it sounds like a track I need to listen to again. I have to say, I haven't. I obviously have played it kind of at some point, but I couldn't bring it to mind. But it sounds like a perfect description of Hawkwind, you know, as a jam band at their best, where they just kind of keep it going and it kind of keeps you in the zone, but they do enough to keep it interesting.
Absolutely. So we've had Cosmic Northern Soul from Joe and Water Droplets in Zero Gravity from Matt. I kind of feel like I need to up my game. But what I can bring to the table now, it almost feels like cheating because I like Motorhead so much that to me, it feels like it is on the album release, particularly because that album ends with a track that I'm less keen on. And then Motorhead is the first bonus track. So I've, apart from when we were doing the album for the podcast, I tend to, when I'm listening to it, let it run when I'm streaming it, to include Motorhead. So it feels like it's actually canon, if you see what I mean. But I love Motorhead, love the track. My favoured version is actually the version that has Dave's vocal, because Hawkwind's really loose, jammy way of playing that seems to fit Dave's folky voice. Even the way it begins with the guy just setting up the drum beat and you hear the engineer rolling, the whole thing just works beautifully for me. So yeah, it's weird to pull out as a bonus track simply because it just feels like it's part of the original album.
It's funny. I would agree with you that I like the Brock version better. I mean, they're playing, I think, just as a power trio on that. It's just Brock and Lemmy and Alan Powell, actually, rather than Simon King plays the drums on that one. And it's one of those songs which, I don't know, should it have actually been on Warrior rather than Kings of Speed?
Yeah, I think so.
But I don't know, maybe they were kind of falling out with Lemmy at the time. I don't know. It's tremendous. And I think there's still a lot of people out there who are surprised when they hear that Motorhead was in fact first a Hawkwind song before it was a Motorhead song.
Absolutely.
I mean, we talked about this quite a lot on the episode, and I completely agree that it's a cool track. And I personally prefer this version. I think we talked about before that although I like the idea of Motorhead, I'm not a big Motorhead listener. For me, it's a little bit fast and a little bit noisy for the kind of rock that I enjoy. But when we did compare them for the podcast, I did like the fact that it showed again that Hawkwind seems to be able to, at least in some way, shape or form, absorb an idea and turn it into something ownable for them in their process. When you listen to Lemmy's Motorhead, it is kind of like a balls to the wall, doesn't stop joint. And the Hawkwind version is like I said before, it's like, oh yeah, we'll take that idea. That's interesting. Okay, we want to be a bit gruff, but how about we throw a saxophone in there? What happens? How about we do this and that? You know, there's that feeling where just like they take it and by the time it's finished, it's never how it started. It goes through this strange evolution. So I did enjoy this version of Motorhead, and actually, like you, I think that it's a nice way of ending that album.
I first heard it on the Independent Days EP that also had Motorway City on it and couple of other bits and pieces, and it was amusingly it was subtitled, it was called Motorhead brackets The Way It Should Have Been, which I found to be amusingly cheeky. So Joe, you are now bringing us a bit of Prime Calvert.
So my third choice is an interesting one. We Like to Be Frightened. It was first demoed, I think, in 1977. 1977 was an incredibly fertile year for them. There's a lot of unreleased music from that year, which supposedly has been, you know, it's going to be released, and then it's not going to be released, and then it's going to be released, and then it's not going to be released. So there's a lot of stuff in there. And one of the tracks they demoed in 77 was We Like to Be Frightened. But the recording on the PXR5 Atom Henge release is a proper studio recording. It's not a demo. This was one of the tracks they recorded at the PXR5 sessions. And for whatever reason, they decided not to put it on the album. It may possibly be because it's a Calvert track, solely written by Calvert. Brock's not involved. And by the time they were compiling PXR5, they'd had a bit of a falling out with Calvert. And so maybe that was one of the reasons why they decided they weren't going to put it on. But maybe also that they thought it was too poppy. I mean, it's a pop song. There's no two ways about it. A very funny Calvert-esque pop song with a kind of one of his very sly and clever lyrics, but still very much a pop song and with a great chorus. What else can you say about it? I mean, it was Calvert eventually recorded it for his own album, for the Hype album in 81. So it did finally kind of come out, and that version on Hype is a much more electronic, whereas this one is just a great piece of clever pop rock, basically.
I always find, especially when you or Andy talk about the life outside the band, the pettiness of Hawkwind is matched only by their experimental attitudes in the studio. I do find their ability to, you know, throw their own albums out of windows, fire people for no reason, run away when someone goes mad. But then it seems to be such a strange, like, passive-aggressive band a lot of the time. So that's always just, that's amazing to know that happened. But I did listen to We Like to Be Frightened a few times because that one came back to me. It's like you said, for a pop song, it's super short. It's like less than 3 minutes. So it's very short for a Hawkwind track. I think sometimes I said before that sometimes Hawkwind tracks are too long or too short. This one feels like it's about where it should be. I like the fact that We Like to Be Frightened has a pop edge and has a little sinisterness to it, even, you know, in the name of the track and then the thought process through the lyrics. But it's delivered in a way where it feels like this track could almost be a gateway drug to people to listen and then go and check out the rest of the band and get pulled in. They've sugared the pill slightly to see whether or not there's a way of getting that out there and seeing whether or not it reels people in. It feels a little bit like an interesting Hawkwind fishing expedition into potentially, like I said, a more pop culture, because there aren't many tracks, even really like Silver Machine up to a point. It's not trying to be poppy. It's of the time and it's groovy and everything, but it's not straight up pop. It's still a bit of like a dance record. So so Hawkwind going out into this area is interesting to see.
To me, it's interesting in as much as if you were to ask, well, Calvert's left Hawkwind and in a few years' time, he's going to be bringing out solo albums. I wonder what he'll do. You listen to We Like to Be Frightened and you go, he's going to do that. It's the absolute signal, I think, for what he then does, you know, a few years later and turns into his solo career. Not perhaps in the instrumentation, because as you say, Joe, he goes down more an electronic route. But from a vibe and a feel point of view, it's like pure solo Calvert to me. And a lovely one, for sure. And as you say, not a demo, it's the fully realized thing. There must be a reason, such as you suggest, because for Hawkwind to actually completely record and polish and produce a track and then not use it, there's a reason behind that, because pretty much everything else finds its way onto an album somewhere along the line. They're not a band to needlessly record more than they need to, are they?
Yeah, absolutely. I would certainly have preferred this track to a couple of the other tracks on PXR5. Even just as we were talking about it, I just have this vision of what a great single it would have made. I can see a particularly, you know, naff video with them all dressed up as, like, you know, Frankenstein and Dracula, like in the lyrics, and playing it on, you know, Cheggers Plays Pop and stuff.
There's a thought. Matt, you bring to the table for your final choice another unreleased version of a track that we quite liked.
An extended version. And again, I was really happy to have found this. I listened to tracks like Brain Box Pollution, and I actually put them all into a separate Spotify playlist and was going through them over the course of a couple of weeks, and were deleting ones I immediately didn't like, and then going through and going through to try to get myself down to three. And I always just found it interesting that despite all the brand new tracks that existed, the fact that there was a 6-minute version of Fable for a Failed Race made me so happy, because we talked about that track before. And actually, it's not a particularly long track on the album, but we actually, on the podcast, when I was listening back a little while ago, got a good length of time out of it. There's 6 or 7 lines in the entire track, and it gets the story of an entire civilization down into like this very small lament and gives you a lot to think about. And what this track does is gives you a beautiful musical accompaniment to ponder on it rather than ponder on it after the track is finished. I always like this track. I love the way it was delivered. I love the swirling feel that, again, Hawkwind can create, this kind of like audio miasma again, where just things come together, but they complement each other. And again, they create these kind of like waves and striations. You don't feel like they're slamming against each other. You do feel like they're all just aiding this feeling of kind of mist that is walking you through the story. And it doesn't really do anything more than the original track does, only it does more of it, which I believe I said in the podcast, is that if this track was twice as long, it would be twice as good. And it is, and it is. So there isn't much more to say about it, apart from everything I loved about it, and there's more of it, and that's great.
Sounds about right. Joe, did you have a fondness for the original version of it that you would be thinking, oh, I could do with a little bit more of that?
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, it made complete sense when the longer version came out. You think, aha, of course, you know, this is actually cut down because it fades in on the album and it fades out on the album. So clearly something could be going on before and afterwards. And it is such a lovely track. And I think particularly on this longer version, they seem to have pumped up the swirliness. I mean, it really does conjures up visions of like some kind of desert planet.
Doesn't it? It feels desolate to me. They are able to get this feeling of expanse and desolation from the music, which has always captured me and I always feel when I hear it.
Yeah, oceanic is probably the kind of way I described it, because it's the swirliness is this kind of very natural kind of swirliness. But as you say as well, kind of it's splendid desolation, I guess. So yeah, another really beautiful track.
And if you were to make your own playlist version of the album, you'd be quite happy to kind of swap them out so that you actually just had the longer version was the album version. I can imagine maybe that perhaps playing time on the vinyl was the reason to cut it down. I don't really know, maybe. But yeah, a good discovery for sure.
I was reading an old press release about Quark, Strangeness and Charm, and I'd never seen this before. And Calvert's talking about it, and he actually says that the first side of Quark is actually meant to be one long conceptual story. It's actually a conceptual side. So, and which actually, I mean, you know, because all the music goes together and it does feel like, you know, you've got the Spirit of the Age at the start, where you've got this vision of a fairly sterile future, Damnation Alley, you know, it's all gone to hell. And then Fable of a Failed Race, I always imagined this as the aliens kind of landing on Earth after Earth has kind of finished and thinking that they're going to this fertile planet and just discovering a desert planet. But I kind of think particularly with the longer version of Fable of a Failed Race, if you kind of ran that in, I think that would work, you know, even better. Because as you say, it's a bit short on the album. But yeah, so there you go. Kind of First Side of Quark is a concept.
You called that out on the podcast. You said that you thought these two were one side of a story and the other side of a story. I never thought that. I always thought that this was almost a kind of Star Trek moment where we had gone exploring and we'd found a race and we'd found the remnants of it. And this was almost like the tablet that we picked up that explained why there wasn't anything there. But it obviously works completely well the other way around. So it's interesting that you actually called that.
Yeah, I'm feeling quite smug now. I didn't see Spirit of the Age being connected to Damnation Alley. That was a link that I missed for sure. But Damnation Alley, we're in this kind of Mad Max ruining the world thing. And then many years later, Fable of a Failed Race, and the aliens come down and go, oh, they really messed this up, didn't they? That, you know, that totally made sense to me. So that's great. No, good bit of knowledge there.
That would be funny, though, if the way that Spirit of the Age and Damnation Alley works. You've got one guy who's a clone in space writing a letter to his supposed, like, beloved or friend or whatever, and they, like, send it off. In the meantime, because of the time difference, that beloved is now in a death jeep going across a destroyed America going, oh, Jesus!
It's the trilogy that needs to be made.
Why didn't you sign those forms, Dad? This sucks.
For sure.
I guess, like, if Spirit of the Age is 8 minutes, Damnation and Alley is 9 minutes, if also Fable of a Failed Race was 7 minutes on the album, it may have been too much. And I guess if you're going to cut down one of them, you can get the point of Fable for a Failed Race.
Yeah, that's
quickly.
Fair.
However, it, again, a bit like Minor Jam for me, if you can pluck that out as a completely finished track in its own right, then that's a great track to share with people.
Absolutely. So the final track in this little selection of bonus and unreleased tracks from the 1970s is actually a demo track, and it is the acoustic demo of Days of the Underground, which is a great version of the track. And I kind of wish they actually recorded that version of the track. Obviously, the name of the track is quite obviously poached from Joe's fabulous book written about 40 years later. It's an amazing act of
time-traveling plagiarism.
Time-traveling, exactly. And Heinous Crime, though it is, but it's a great song. And I love that rolling feel to it. And the fact that it is acoustic, to me, makes it feel more of the time that it's talking about. And I love the version of it that is the canon version on the album. But I find now that whenever I play it, I kind of have to play both of them back to back. I can't quite accept either of them over the other. It would have been a great double A-side. But yeah, I love that version. I wish they'd fleshed it out and actually turned it into a completely finalized, produced track. But it's definitely one that I'm very fond of.
Well, it was interesting. When I saw that you'd chosen this, I thought, what's this? And again, I must have heard it at some point, but I had to look it up and I did listen to it. And as you say, it is an interesting version. I love particularly the acoustic guitar on it. I think is great. But Calvert's vocal is just... He really sounds like he's on something on this kind of particular version. I mean, he really does.
Sure,
you know, he's and he's really playing that whole thing up. And it's funny. I mean, you know, and he's obviously still working through the lyrics because he repeats himself a few times, you know, so it really is just a kind of run through. But again, kind of if you contrast that with what they were doing even just like a couple of years before, you know, this is a completely different sound. And it's something I'll perhaps talk about in a bit. But when I did the book, the thing that always astonished me as I was going through the albums was to say that this is a band that are always accused of sounding the same. They sound so different from album to album in the 1970s. And this song in particular really brought it home to me, I thought.
Completely. I personally like the album version a lot. I think that it's one of the first tracks which I feel like the loop that they use is almost proto hip hop, and the way that they tell their story almost feels like that. I guess it has a more kind of beat poet kind of thing to it. I feel like the whole track is great. The story is fantastic. For me, a little bit to what Joe said, that the delivery is still odd in the album version, but because of the music going around it. And I feel like there's some kind of tremolo, or like they've recorded it into a tape machine or something. You know, there's a little stutter in the delivery, which again just adds to this almost like archival piece. Like they found these reels from, you know, like the underground. They've literally unearthed them and they're playing them. There's that feeling of like datedness to it. And I feel like that doesn't come over quite so much in the acoustic version, just because the arrangement that they have. So I feel like he's almost trying to add the strangeness using the power of his voice. For me, this feels like a look behind the curtain of how it happened. And I like the fact that they shared it. It's really interesting, but I do like where they got to more personally.
Yeah, if Peter Jackson ever finds the footage from the recording sessions, you can imagine watching the band and Calvert piece this track together and seeing it evolve into what eventually became like McCartney doing Get Back. I've just compared Calvert and McCartney, which I'm not sure that's ever been done before, but I quite like it. I'll roll with it. So those are our best of the bonus tracks and the unreleased tracks from the 1970s. It's our little coda to the studio albums that we've been looking at during this season one. And Matt, we've made a bit of a playlist of those, have we not?
We have. To accompany the three sessions playlists and the master playlist, we now have the best of the bonus tracks 70s edition. Those nine tracks will be added, which then bring to a close our digital archive of Hawk Binge of the 70s. So they will all be available to listen to on Spotify. We will link those out in our show notes. Also, if you search Hawk Binge on Spotify, we're pretty much the only thing that comes up. Yeah, that kind of draws a line under those playlists, and we'll be looking to create the season two playlists when we start all over again.
Indeed. So, Joe, during these last however many episodes we've done, we've read fairly liberally from your wonderful book. Just in getting into, you know, your story and the story of you writing that book, where does your Hawkwind journey begin? You actually mentioned buying the Friends and Relations. Is that where it started for you?
No, it started a long time before then. I was lucky enough to have a classic older brother. He's 13 years older than me, and so he had a pretty good record collection, you know, all of the classic 70s stuff, a lot of Pink Floyd and Deep Purple, Yes, Led Zeppelin. And so he would be playing all of this music when I was growing up, literally, you know, 7, 8, 9 year old. I would hear it through his bedroom wall. But one album that he had, which stood out from all of the others, even to my young ears, was this amazing album, which had this fold out shield. And that was, of course, War on the Edge of Time. And even as a 9 year old, I remember kind of thinking, this doesn't sound like the other stuff. And I really like it, but I don't know why I really like it. And actually, and I know that I think when you talked about Warrior, you were slightly slagging off the spoken word tracks. But I have to say, as a 9 year old, I found Standing on the Edge, I found that an utterly, utterly terrifying track. Because it's not the kind of thing you suddenly expect to kind of hear on a record. You know, Deep Purple weren't doing that, that's for sure. And that still really kind of stayed with me. And that's why, you know, I'm completely unobjective about Warrior. It will always be my favorite, certainly favorite studio album. Because then the next thing was when I then was a bit older and started kind of seriously getting into music about the age of 12 and 13. We had a very good record selection in our local library. And one of the first records I saw there and got out was Space Ritual. Putting this on and just thinking, what the hell is this? This doesn't sound like anything else. You know, it was so disorientating, but you kept on going back to because it was so different. And then when it clicked, then I think that was probably it, really. I mean, that was when Hawkwind were embedded in my musical soul, if you like. There's no point were they ever going to leave it. And then I think, as I said, yeah, the first vinyl I actually bought would have been Friends and Relations Volume 1 when I was 14. And I also got a cassette twofer of Quark and PXR5. So that was a major introduction to Calvert. So this was in the early 80s when I was kind of really following them. So I saw them on things like the Black Sword Tour. But it really was the 1970s music that really, really got a hold of me and ultimately inspired me to write the book.
You know, you've listened to Space Ritual, you love Warrior on the Edge of Time, and then suddenly you've got Quark, Strangeness and Charm or PXR5. That shift, how did that feel to you?
That was obviously one of the attractions about Hawkwind is that they do, in a way, always sound the same. But that's to do a lot with the way that Dave Brock plays the guitar, some of their approaches to songwriting. But sonically, they're kind of so different. And obviously, you know, the difference between Calvert albums and some of the earlier ones is pretty vast. But that's what I found really, really appealing. And you got to remember that this was like the early 80s. It's completely, obviously, pre-internet. This was when it was difficult to even find out, even from a few years ago, what bands had released, and to actually get the kind of discography in your head and actually work out where these albums fitted. And it was like, you know, you look at the back, okay, so Quark's 1977. 77, okay, but then Hawklaws is 78, and then kind of what is Hawklaws anyway? Why did they change their name? None of this information was available. Now you can just look it up or read my book, and it's there. But you know, this stuff just wasn't there. And it one of the attractions of Hawkwind, they're one of these bands that has this such a mythical dimension to it, and kind of stuff happening that's still not clear why it happened that makes them so attractive. They are a mysterious force. They really are.
So do you see Hawkwind to you as kind of a puzzle to be solved in some way? Is that part of the reason why you wrote the book, or is it more about explaining to other people that this existed? Because it feels like immediately when you started to listen to it, you were starting to ask these questions and you were starting to realize that there were anomalies which maybe would have passed other people by, or maybe if you'd only heard one or two tracks, not albums, you wouldn't have realized. And they are, you know, even just from talking to Andy and reading your book kind of vicariously through him through the podcast and learning about the band myself, it does feel like it's a fun band to talk about.
The whole kind of approach I took to writing the book, and I'm so lucky to have had a publisher like Strange Attractor, because I'm not sure that most publishers would have actually gone for my pitch, which was basically, I'm trying to not so much solve the mystery of Hawkwind, but it's very much about an interpretation of them. I mean, I was very keen on telling the story as factually and truthfully correct as I could, because I know that that had been an issue in the past. And, you know, I think I got it as accurate as I could. From a detective point of view, that's fun to do. But I mean, you know, the really fun thing about Hawkwind is, as I say, the mythical, mysterious dimension to them. And that was what I really, really wanted to bring out. And in a way, I had kind of thought that I wasn't really actually going to even interview that many people, because I was so het up on the idea that it was all about the interpretation of the music and how they fitted in with the kind of counterculture of the 1970s, and the fact that the 1970s were the real days of the underground. Everybody talks about the end of the 60s being where it's at, man, but you know, that was a small scene in London and maybe a couple of other cities, whereas the days of the underground is very much the first half of the 70s, where the whole counterculture is spread out to the provinces and all around Britain. And Hawkwind are absolutely, you know, integral to this, that spread of that underground culture and underground sensibility. And so the way that they tapped into something much bigger than what they were was obviously appealing. But, you know, at a basic level, as you heard me talking about at the start there, I just absolutely love the music. They're like nothing else. There are no other bands in Britain that even vaguely sounded like them in the 1970s, and they're still a completely unique band. You know, and obviously, I guess, kind of tied up with my early musical enthusiasm, if you like, as well. It's something that never kind of leaves you. And so all of that together was really the ball of inspiration for the book.
You were already a music writer, is that correct? You were writing for The Quietus.
One of the first things I wrote for The Quietus was an anniversary piece on Space Ritual. It was like a proto take on what I talk about in the book and try to bring in the cultural aspect of it. And that got a really tremendous reaction. And bizarrely enough, got picked up by the French magazine Rock and Folk, who were basically like the Rolling Stone of the French media. And they wanted to reprint it. And so that really kickstarted me, because they translated it and reprinted it. Then I started writing a load of stuff for them in a similar vein, all of which was published in French, hasn't it? Never been published in English. I kind of thinking I must get round to somehow kind of publishing some of this stuff, because it's quite good. But the only reason I was smiling when you were talking about writing about music, I started writing about music in 2013 for The Quietus, and I'd done bits and pieces beforehand, but I don't come from a journalism background. You know, my background is in public relations. And the only reason I started writing about music was that I basically stopped being in public relations because I'd stopped my job to look after my daughters. And once I'd managed to ship them off to nursery, I suddenly found I had a bit of time on my hands. And so this was something just to do. And I've been involved in all kinds of writing projects. I used to write screenplays and I've written books and stuff like that. A novel, which didn't get published, and thank God for that. So I've always been involved in writing, but then suddenly, you know, here was a subject, you know, that I was naturally know something about. And, you know, as it was, once I put the pitch together for Days of the Underground, or what became Days of the Underground, I got the contract with Strange Attractor indecently quickly, because, you know, it just so happened that Mark there is a massive Hawkwind fan. And he said, yeah, brilliant. And that was that. But yes, yeah, so that kind of early feature in The Quietus was a big inspiration for it. And the original thing that I decided to do off the back of that was to try and do a 33 and a third book about Space Ritual. And so I put a proposal together for that, and that went absolutely nowhere. You know, I thought I there's something bigger to write here anyway. And that's when I put together the pitch for the whole book. And as I said, I was fortunate enough to very quickly have somebody say yes to me.
There is no one else like them for having the ultimate story that most people don't know. You don't have to be a fan of Black Sabbath to kind of know the Black Sabbath story or the Beatles story or whatever. But unless you are a Hawkwind fan, these stories are not known at all. And there's the two stories. There's the band story and there's the musical journey. And they go hand in hand, obviously. We focus on the podcast with the musical journey and we touch very lightly on those band history because really that would almost be another podcast in itself. And there are brilliant storytellers such as yourself and Ian who can tell that band history that we can just dip into and refer to. But it is such a hidden story. When I tell friends of mine, most friends of mine have no idea about Hawkwind. And I say, I've got this podcast. And they go, what's it about? And I go, Hawkwind. And they kind of go, okay, well, you know, why Hawkwind? And then it's like, wow, there's this weird hidden history that once you pop the lid on it, the stories just keep flying and flying and flying. The Hawkwind story seems to carry equal weird weight, whichever part of the journey you're on. I mean, it must be the drive that you had to write the book about Hawkwind. You must have had a feeling all along that this was just a magnificent story that people don't know about.
I think so. You know, just from a practical point of view, just the fact that Hawkwind, for a period of about 3 years, from probably about 72 to 75, were a seriously big band. They were playing Wembley. They were playing to 10,000 people in the States. They weren't megastars by any means, but they were potentially, you know, on the cusp. They were going there. And of course, kind of, you know, they did their usual self-sabotage job and didn't happen in the end. But certainly just to say to people that people have forgotten what a big band they were. But also just, as I say, coming back to them as this idea of the of being the heralds of the underground. These are the people who helped to create the underground in Britain. They were always there. They were taking the good news of the counterculture around the country. And I think that, from a cultural point of view, is really, really important. And, you know, and that's not even talking about the way that they're the ultimate science fiction band as well. That's another aspect of them. I think what it came down to is there was just so much stuff to write about. It was like, God, you know, when do you stop more than anything else? My first draft was something like 215,000 words. I mean, it was about 900 pages. So, you know, there was so much material and there still is.
Well, look, it's a beautiful book. I've really enjoyed reading it. Matt now, of course, is allowed to read it properly. Now we've reached the end of the 70s. We have one episode left in which there will be a bit of a reading from the book because you do cover Levitation a little bit. And after that, there will be a bit of a Days of the Underground shaped hole. I have found a book to bring in, but it's been an absolute pleasure. Tell us a little bit about the cover, actually, because that cover is beautiful.
That's by John Coulthart, who, Matt, you won't have encountered yet, but he is a guy who starts doing some of the cover art for the early 80s albums. And he literally did it when he was a schoolboy, 16, 17, 18 year old, who had sent his drawings to Dave Brock somehow and started getting involved kind of illustrating Hawkwind's covers. And he's since gone to become a very respected fantasy artist. But fantasy much more in the kind of H.P. Lovecraft kind of side of things rather than Games of Thrones or whatever. But yeah, so he was somebody who Mark at Strange Attractor knew and just suggested, you know, saying that we're doing this Hawkwind book. Do you fancy doing a cover for it? And yeah, before you know it, he said, yep, I do. And here you go. And it's a lovely cover. I mean, I remember when I first saw it, I was a bit like, wow, because it is very in your face. I mean, we'd originally had a cover idea, which was a lot more abstract than that. And this was suddenly going for something that was very, very iconic. It, you know, looked very much like an iconic Hawkwind cover. This is a genuine piece of Hawkwind art. And so, yeah, I'm incredibly proud that it graces the book.
Beautiful it is too. And it's a wonderful book. And that is Days of the Underground, Radical Escapism in the Age of Paranoia. I've been getting that wrong a little bit, but I managed to get it right this time. So we are now going to go back to some things that have been said in some previous episodes. Matt has come across some tracks that he has not been best pleased with and has made some completely egregious comments about. And Joe, on behalf of Hawkwind Nation, now has the right of reply. So we have five of these. We've picked out the five most heinous crimes. Item number one is paranoia, parts 1 and 2 from the debut album. And comments here included, speeding down of the record is a cheap trick. I wonder why they even have part 1 on the record. And finally, it sounds like John Carpenter does Jaws. Joe, would you like to retort?
Well, personally, I think John Carpenter does Jaws sounds like a tremendous description of a track. I would listen to any track that was described in that way. I don't know whether, Matt, now that you've made your way through the 1970s, whether you look back in these comments and think, oh, actually, now I kind of see it in the context of where they went, it kind of makes a bit more sense. But why does it have part one of the record? I actually really like the fact that there's this kind of short excerpt at the end of side one. I think of it as like a trailer for the song to come. It's like a film trailer because, I mean, the actual track itself, it's not subtle, to say the least. But if you imagine it as like a soundtrack to like a Italian bloodstained thrillers from the 60s and 70s that Italy was famous for, I could imagine this music on the soundtrack as the knife-wielding maniac closes in on the helpless female. It's I guess, kind of like the freakiest track on the album. They wouldn't try to be as obviously freaky as this again, I think. It always reminds me of Careful With That Axe, Eugene, at the start. I don't know why. Kind of a similar idea of then kind of starting with bass and then kind of exploding. But yeah, I mean, it's I think it's a good track. I like it, but I could well understand, Matt, that you just thought it was like a headache on vinyl.
Matt, does the prosecution have anything to say?
I think that of all the albums that we've listened to in the 70s era of Hawkwind, the original one is the one I like least still. I think that putting Harry on Sundown at the beginning and then dissolving into things like Paranoia Parts 1 and 2 really did not help introduce me to the band in a way which made me really understand what they were trying to do. I still think the Motor Off Effect, while maybe fun in the 70s, I find just annoying now. And again, I am purely judging this from a contemporary listening point of view. I still don't personally think the tracks work. I do kind of stand by my comments on that one. I know that I originally, and I know that obviously the fact that the first album I had probably the least nice things to say about things, so I didn't get it yet. I was wondering, would we ever get more than one listener past episode one? Because I feel like if you like Hawkwind and you go, oh, a Hawkwind podcast, that's nice. And then you hear someone just saying how you don't understand an album and it's stupid. That's obviously not the kind of thing that makes you want to listen to episode two. But I'm very glad that lots of people have. For me as well, Paranoia Parts 1 and 2 slightly are a representation of all the little tracks that Hawkwind throw into their albums, which I don't really know why. For me, never do much more than just fill some space before they get into something more meaty, which is what I like from Hawkwind. I think, I can't remember which track it was, but I called one of them the equivalent of like one of those packing peanuts that Amazon throw into bags so you don't break your stuff. And I feel like that's what they are for me. They're packing peanuts. They're not sonically interesting enough for me to like really get into them or like miss them when they're not around. So, yeah.
So Matt and his Heart of Stone are unmoved on case one. Move to case two, which is an interesting little one, on the Hall of the Mountain Grill, which was my first Hawkwind album. And that track is Web Weaver, and items for discussion here. And that said, Web Weaver feels like Hawkwind has been told to be tight and musical for the whole album. Then they just explode and make Web Weaver. The whole thing is sonically chaotic while being oddly upbeat, which I kind of took as a compliment. And then the most interesting thing about the track is that it has a piano on it. Would the defense like to comment?
I kind of agree to a certain extent on this track. It's basically starts off as a faster version of You Know You're Only Dreaming. And then it goes into what can only be described as it's probably Hawkwind's one and only foray into kind of country rock. Or kind of that bluegrass kind of rock thing with the piano, which I like actually is quite nice. I mean, it's very un-Hawkwindy, but it's quite a nice thing that they're trying out. But I have to say that, I mean, ultimately it's a relatively minor track for me. And I know that some people will be shouting at their computer as I say that, because for a lot of people, Hall of the Mountain Grill is up there with Warrior. In fact, better than Warrior for a lot of people. But I've always found it, I don't know. I mean, some of the tracks are obviously absolutely terrific on it, but it's never cohered for me for some reason, that album. And Web Weaver was always just the song at the end of side one after they'd done the kind of more interesting tracks. So I'm afraid I can't mount a very good defense for it.
Terrible attempt at defending the track there from Joe. Is Matt's just going to pounce on that one?
I think the problem with Webweaver for me is that it's kind of guilty of nothing more than being the track after D-Rider. And considering how much I love D-Rider, any track that wasn't going to really come out swinging was going to be encumbered from my liking of it. And I wonder whether or not Webweaver, because it's so weird and different, that they thought that that would be okay. And for me, it does something kind of interesting, like you wonder where it's going for the first minute and a half. I think it is the first time that I've really heard Hawkwind have a piano in it. So I was like, oh, this is an interesting new instrument. I wonder where this is going. Then it kind of goes into, yeah, this kind of like honky tonk thing that makes me just want to kind of like jig. And then like after something like D-Rider, I'm like, I love that you're being experimental, guys, but this is not what I wanted after this. I'm on some kind of peak and then I get this track. So it in itself is fine. Oddly jaunty in a way which I feel like is incongruous for the rest of the record. I don't think that the piano is helping much. And like you said, the fact that it sounds a bit like You're Only Dreaming again further makes me feel like it just feels a bit like derivative and nowhere near as good as the track You're Only Dreaming, which is a masterful track. So
I think if the only byline you can put under Webweaver is that it's oddly jaunty, I think it's probably done for. So no love for Webweaver in this court. No right of appeal. Number three is an absolute doozy. Matt said of this, what the hell is this? He commented that I wondered if Hawkwind were deliberately trying to annoy me. He sent me a private message, which I'll now reveal, where he said, a pretty decent album with one massive clanger on it. The track feels adolescent and it doesn't feel like Hawkwind to me. So an epic rant about The Flying Doctor.
Good luck with this one, Joe.
I think I actually really like Flying Doctor, though, for all of the fact it is a deeply stupid track. You know, the riff is stupid. The whole kind of wobble board and the jaw harp. I mean, it's almost like trying to get so stupid that it actually becomes profound. And you've got Calvert's kind of ludicrous Australian accent. But I think, as you said in the podcast, you know, this is just par for the course at the time. Just putting on an Australian accent was a funny thing to do. This goes back to even things like Monty Python, you know, with the Philosopher's Song and the fact that all Australians are all ockers with corks hanging off a hat. And Calvert, I just imagine him seeing somewhere a story about how doctors in the outback had been abusing their pharmaceutical supplies and just thought, well, there you go. I mean, that's a song that writes itself, Flying Doctor. Oh, I think there's two layers there. It works in the William Burroughs reference as well. Perform the appendectomy, we're about to chew it out. All of that is actually an adapted line from The Naked Lunch. He's just kind of got all of this kind of stuff kind of thrown in. The cabinet key chant is, again, massively stupid and massively brilliant. Just goes on and on and on. Particularly at the end, you're thinking this isn't going to end. It's just going on and on and on. I think it's entirely incongruous to the album. You do kind of wonder what it's doing there, but I have to say I do like it a lot and it still makes me smile. That probably is a poor reflection on me.
I think I said in the podcast that time had sweetened the track a bit, but it still wasn't going to get away with being panned. I was almost hoping when we were going through the B-sides that there was a more palatable version of this, but there wasn't. Maybe sometimes I am guilty of trying to hold Hawkwind to standards that they themselves have set for themselves but don't wish to adhere to. Because they sometimes do amazing things and then sometimes go completely off the deep end. And I felt like this was one of those. Like you said, with the things like the inclusion of the jaw harp and that kind of thing, it's not like they're not taking this in with some degree of seriousness. You know, they put the effort in. They're like, okay, fine, I'll do the accent. You go to whatever instrument shop and find an Australian instrument. We're going to be as Australian as possible. We're going to let people know that this is where this is. So if they'd have just knocked it out in the studio for a laugh, it wouldn't have been as interesting. It may have been better. I don't know. It's hard to tell. But they bring in things like the cabinet key. Like I said at the podcast, that if I was down the front shouting cabinet key when this is on, I would have a great time. So it is a kind of thing where if you turn your brain off, it's a better track. But again, I don't think that's a good sign the fact that you need to literally remove your sense of what is good in order to enjoy it, then it's still probably not good. The fact I can do that is more an ability on me than them, I would say. So yeah, it's still not a track that I enjoy, although I do also kind of enjoy it.
There's a partial...
It's a paradox, yeah. This track. I really wish that it didn't exist so I wouldn't have to try to reconcile it.
But there is some reconsideration going on. Then we come to number four, which is actually part of a track rather than the whole thing, but with one of the more legendary statements which has gone down from Hawk Binge history. The track is "Time We Left This World Today." And the comment that kind of sparked the whole thing off was where Matt said it makes a weird transition into the clown car section. Basically, clown car section has come back to haunt us in a number of messages. Matt said it's so weird. It's totally bonkers. And I don't know why it does it. And then eventually I grasp onto the return of the original riff like a drowning man. Can you defend the clown car section, Joe?
No, I can't. No. I have to say, I thought that was that's bang to rights. I think I mentioned this in the book, that this is the one Hawkwind track where you can really hear the drugs kick in. They're kind of going okay. They've got the riff. They're doing a bit of the chant. And then it just kind of breaks down in the middle. And in a way, it's fascinating that they decided, yeah, this is the version we're going to go for, which either means God knows what the other versions were like. In its own way, it's a brilliant example of keeping it together. You know, it sounds like it's going to fall apart at any moment. In a way, I think there's a good display here of the type of telepathy between Brock and Lemmy that Brock was always talking about. I mean, Lemmy kind of holds this track together. But yeah, it does sound like not so much a clown car section as well. I mean, it's clown car on some terrible hallucinogenic drug. This is the fun fair to kind of end all fun fairs. But I mean, in a way, all the better then, like you say, when the riff comes back and you're like, oh, thank God we made it out. We made it to the other side. And that in a way is quite enjoyable. And obviously the version that you get on Space Ritual is like a million times tighter and kind of expunges most of this middle section. Certainly it's edited out on Space Ritual. But yeah, I feel that this is a real insight into Hawkwind's working methods, if nothing else.
This is a guilty as charged then, Matt.
Maybe, although I feel like I've become more predisposed to it than I did originally.
This is a strange turn of events I didn't see coming.
Yeah, that was said definitely when I was only a few albums into Hawkwind and seeing where they were going. And actually, I know that, Joe, you actually said something in the book, because after I'd gone on about this track, Andy then read a passage which kind of felt like it was the audio equivalent of a rolled up newspaper, like hitting me down for having a go at this track. But you talked about something about radical primitivism or something like that. And I remember taking that away at the end of the podcast. And there was something nice about the fact that when we do these conversations, we haven't really spoken about it before. So the exchange of information is real. And I hope that comes over when people listen. And I did take that and I listened to it again. And although I don't listen to this track all the time, it now fills a particular mind frame for me when I do enjoy seeing how far you can color outside of the lines. I wondered whether or not this is a little bit like when people first listen to jazz. By the time I was listening to jazz, I'd normalized jazz. My parents had jazz records. They're like, this is good. And I listen to it and I'm like, okay. And then you kind of understand it. But you can imagine someone listening to it for the first time, maybe who had no idea of the ability to, you know, play all the notes at once and that kind of thing, and being like, I don't know what's going on. I felt like this was almost my, what they were like listening to jazz moment, where I was like, this is completely fallen apart. This is just garbage and they're being stupid. And then they just remember they should be doing a track and then they come back in. But now it feels more like they deliberately let themselves go off the rails, but they're always just, even if it's by a finger, they're just hanging onto the cliff. And then the actual resolution back into the track is actually immensely satisfying. I feel like I'm being teased sonically when I know it's going to come back. Is that kind of like, oh, do you want it? No, then you can have it. And you feel like in a way your brain is like, I've been battered around so much that I feel like I've earned this resolution. And then when it comes back, it's actually quite euphoric. And again, like we've talked about very strange bands, like, you know, we talked about Yen Tech, we talked about Sun, we talked about lots of bands that we listen to that go outside the realms of where you think things should go, but they normally start there and carry on. So the idea of a track which starts kind of normal, quote unquote, and then does this and then comes back, I actually appreciate a lot more. It's not something that I listen to all the time, but now I do feel more like I get what they did. So this one, I now apologize for my previous comments.
We have a retraction, but I'm just going to say Clown Car and leave that hanging. All four of these ones so far, they are just the build-up. Mm. For this last one, I think someone's going to have to... So someone there, Joe, who can hold you back so that you don't kick the laptop across the room of violent rage, of righteous fury, because this one was Matt's attack on assault and battery. Not the Golden Void, which Matt liked very much, but the savagery on assault and battery, in which he said it feels very unHawkwind. Felt very lazy in execution, which makes the track feel ponderous. The hi-hats are distractingly high in the mix and feel offbeat. And then definitely some sarcasm in here. I expect assault and battery to occur on the human anatomy. So that line isn't as clever as Hawkwind seemed to think it is. Joe, off you go.
Yeah, I mean, this is the one where I thought, this cannot be. Matt, you must be on some serious drugs yourself to kind of think that this is on Hawkwind. To me, it's the epitome of Hawkwind. I think that the start, the first 30 seconds of Assault and Battery is some of the most exciting music ever created. It's just such an exciting start to a song. And you're right, the hi-hats are mixed very high, and I think deliberately so. And the guitar is so far back, it's like this kind of black fog. It's not even playing proper chords. It's just this kind of fuzz. But you've got Lemmy's amazing bass line. You've got that Mellotron coming in like a kind of cosmic sunset. It's just an amazing start to a song. And then it lurches into kind of action, if you like. You know, it's got this kind of majestic gait to it, which obviously you've kind of seen it as a slightly ponderous gait, but I would say that it's more majestic. I think it's the most wonderful track. I think, as I said in the book, I think it's the closest that Hawkwind have ever got. And it's to do with the mix as much as anything else to really producing a sonic analog to being on acid. The way that it brings things in and out of the mix, and it makes some things are very, very incredibly clear and in your face. Other bits are kind of off to one side. It seems to play with kind of sonic space. I think it's an amazing track. However, I will give you that it is a ridiculous chorus. You've had the verses, you know, kind of cribbing all of the Longfellow poem. And then you've got the chorus, which doesn't seem to have anything to do with what's gone before. It doesn't quite scan properly. You can tell that Brock is almost running out of breath by the end of singing the chorus, where he just has to kind of go, man, at the end. You know, that kind of, you know what I mean, man? So, yeah, I'll give you that it is not a clever chorus. But, you know, the rest of the track is just an astonishing piece of music. An astonishing piece of sonic design as well. Whether or not they could have set out to make it like that, I don't know, but it's just wonderful. I absolutely love it.
That's a strong case.
It is. Unfortunately, I can't see past the fact that it feels slow and ponderous and uninspired to me. I still find to this day, I try and go back to it to see if my opinion changes on this one, and it doesn't. I feel like arranging tracks very lazily on something like Ableton, where you literally put squares round and then you've kind of made a track, and you can sometimes you just lose the magic of the track by looking at something like an Ableton like workflow, because you just see all the squares of where things are. I just see the squares in this track just sonically. I don't feel that there's any of the jazz, any of the looseness. I feel like the whole thing is corralled very aggressively by the Mellotron chords, which just go on for way too long. It's just big slabs of noise that change periodically. And then the hi-hats are trying to engage some kind of energy by just like going like crazy with like 16 hits. But because they're so high up in the mix, that's all I then end up listening to. And then I don't feel like they're hitting a lot of the time. And I don't think it's swing. I think it is just the fact that they're just like being hit so fast in order to try and make something happen, which for me is still not happening. And then the chorus does nothing to lift it. It actually seems to like drop down in both audio quality and pitch and energy again, and then it can't do anything to save itself. For me, the only thing it can save itself is to just throw the whole track out the window and start playing Golden Void, which, to be honest, makes me feel a lot happier about the whole thing. So, yep, sorry, I still maintain that it's not a track which engages me in any way, and I still don't understand why.
Wow. Well, obviously, music is completely subjective, so there's no outright right or wrong. That said, This court finds in favour of Mr. Joe Banks and sentences Matt to rethink his life goals. Court adjourned.
Kangaroo court.
We've got to the end of the 1970s. We've gone back over a few tracks that you weren't so keen on and kind of revised a few and not revised a few others and found some B-sides. And where do we find ourselves at the end of the 1970s?
I suppose this is another conversation in itself, but Matt, I have to say that it's an incredibly brave thing that you've done to step into, you know, the Hawkwind time stream, given the kind of band that they are and the kind of fanatical following that they have. But it's been really interesting to kind of hear your perspective on things as somebody who clearly has a great knowledge and love of music, but for some reason has never heard Hawkwind before. What do you make of Hawkwind, you know, right from, as you say, that first formative album right up to, you know, PXR5, you know, the journey that they've taken? I mean, is it comparable to any other bands you can think of? I mean, or does it seem kind of entirely unique to you as well?
Hawkwind is one of those ones that I can't really draw an easy comparison to. I think I've said this before, where I feel like trying to grab hold of Hawkwind is like trying to grab hold of a soap in the bath. It's very difficult because as soon as you feel like you've got a grip on it, it pings off in a direction that you weren't ready for. And I think that's because almost every part of it, from the band members to whether or not they know how to play instruments, to whether or not they're talking about space, to whether or not they're talking about fantasy, to whether or not they're doing exceptionally harsh critique on socioeconomic experience of being in the UK in the 70s, that it all changes so much and fluctuates. And you feel like a lot of bands that I know and follow tend to have some kind of through line. And I feel like the Hawkwind doesn't really have that. Their through line is that they don't have a through line. They are up for this experimenting, this idea of like, we'll grab anyone to see whether or not you'll work. And if you do, great. And if you don't, fine, we'll find someone else. We'll do something else. We'll go in a different direction. It has that kind of outsider art quality to it. If their through line is anything, it's the fact that they are completely unswayed by any kind of pressure that other musicians may find themselves in, whether or not that's from a label or from money or from fans or from instrumentation or from what is popular to put in music. I've mentioned the Gorillaz quite a lot. That's a band which I'm a huge fan of, and their output is like 5 or 6 albums, so you can't really compare. But one of the reasons why the Gorillaz is interesting is because they're super experimental, and again, they're done from a position of strength by the bands in them. You know, they don't need the money. They deliberately removed themselves as celebrities, as well-known musicians, from the mix and instead presented illustrated versions of themselves to try and distance themselves and make it about the music. Every album has been a bit different, but still relies on the idea of like samples and collaboration and that kind of thing. And I do wait to see what they bring in next, and they are all different. And I do feel like Hawkwind kind of does that naturally. They didn't need to do all the constrictions that the Gorillaz needed to do in order to make it all about the music, because they are only about the music. So I found it really interesting. I can't believe that I had only ever heard maybe like 2 tracks before I'd talked to Andy about them. I've known Andy for a long time, and he's mentioned Hawkwind a lot just in conversation, and I've never felt compelled to listen to them, which again is just like, that's definitely on me. But doing this chronologically has been really interesting to see how they do change, and to see that strata, I guess, that goes through them all. And one thing that they do give you is if you want to put the time in, there's a lot to unpack. And I've really enjoyed that. Even the stuff that I haven't liked, I can tell you why. You don't just go, oh, that track's rubbish, and move on. You can go, because of this, because of the thing they've done here, I'm not sure that works. And you can always play everything else off against each other, which does make me feel that even the things that I don't like have been done with heart and care and some kind of mission. You don't surf on the top of, you dive in. And even if you don't think about diving in, they'll just pull you under somehow. There'll be some kind of hook where they'll get you. So I've really enjoyed, again, like not really knowing the decade, not knowing the history, not knowing a lot. So I have kind of been listening to this in isolation. And I guess it never occurred to me that Hawkwind had devout fans. And I've heard from a few of them. But I must say that even the angry fans have actually been very polite. So that's been nice.
The one thing that has definitely changed is that with most bands, you listen to one album and you believe that it prepares you for listening to the next one. And with Hawkwind, that's not so. And yet through you, in the, like, fortunately, you listen to these albums a lot before you reach the decision. If these were reaction podcasts, we wouldn't have lasted because on the early albums, your first WhatsApp message to me would generally be, what the hell is this? Because you'd listened to the previous one and we'd analysed it and you'd gone through it and then you'd picked up the next album, put it on, and it was almost like it was starting again. But in the last few albums, you've stopped doing that. So you seem to have kind of reached a point where you know not to go in with any preconceptions of what you've had before.
I think that's definitely true. I also feel like the last couple of albums towards the end of the 70s have been probably the ones which I've come back to, you know, like after reviewing, I've actually listened to a bit more. Quark a bit, definitely 25 Years and definitely PXR5. I think I've enjoyed those. Maybe they feel, again, a bit more well-produced and I always feel like I'm drawn to that. But there are certainly tracks which I love. Actually, I listen to the playlists, you know, just listening to the best of tracks. And I know that we were joking about that a lot of people were saying like Hawkwind is a playlist band and we're like, we're not going to do that. I can see why, because you can grab tracks from Hawkwind and go, right, that's my spacey bit. That's my hardcore bit. That's my, like, whatever the hell this is kind of bit. I feel like it's very easy for you to actually curate your own stuff. But it is also interesting sometimes to just go through an album and just kind of be pulled through what Hawkwind wanted you to be pulled through. And it's not always clean going, but I feel like that's also what you want in some bands. You know, some bands I want to put on like a 07 or something, you know, like I know that it sounds good. It's got a groove. I can put it on while I'm cooking or something. And it's just nice to have and I enjoy it. But I never sat down and really like stared at a 07 record as it's gone around and just watched the needle go through. And then at the end, wondered what that's all about. And I've had to do that with every Hawkwind record. They are records that always demand your attention. And I think that's something that not everyone can do and is certainly worthy of respect.
Interestingly, the idea for the podcast came up because during lockdown, for the first time ever in my life, I played the first four, I think, or maybe the first five, like in a row, because suddenly you just had the time to do it. And I'd never done it before, much like yourself. When I got into Hawkwind, I had Hall of the Mountain Grill, and then I picked up Sonic Attack, and then Quark, Strangers and Charm. And they were just very individual slices of Hawkwind, like in the puzzle. But I never put the puzzle together. I never listened to them in order. So I understood that there were these different lineups and there were these different styles, but I never traced it to see what the journey was. So the interesting thing for me on our Hawk Binge journey has actually been doing exactly that, which is the first time I've ever done it. Did you do that for the book, or have you ever done that before?
That was exactly what I did for the book. And I probably actually hadn't done it before until then. I mean, the way for me of getting into writing the book, because, you know, I knew from the start that I wanted to write about the music as well. There's so many kind of music biographies that managed to do a very good job of talking about, you know, the band and its tours and its various fallings in and out and politics, but somehow there's no talk about the music at all. So I knew that I wanted to talk about the music. And so the way I got into writing the book was literally to sit down and start playing the albums in chronological order and just making notes as I went along. And so, yeah, so that was really probably the first time I'd actually properly done that. I think that's kind of sometimes comes through when I'm talking about the albums in the book, that even I'm surprised at how much they've changed from one album to the next, and trying to kind of imagine what this must have been like at the time. And I think that the fact is that Hawkwind was so much of a thing, a way of life that you bought into, you know, to do with the live shows, but to obviously to do with the whole mythos, sleeve art and stuff like that. I just got the impression for the fans that the albums would come along and they'd be like, yeah, it's a Hawkwind album. They knew that they were going to be changing. I mean, even from, you know, something like Space Ritual to Hall of the Mountain Grill, you know, that's a huge leap. And then from Hall of the Mountain Grill to Quark. I can't think of any other band that genuinely progresses through the decade. I agree that they're clearly not swayed that much by what's going on in the wider musical world. But at the same time, they clearly are taking something from somewhere. You know, they're picking up kind of what's in the air to a certain extent, but they absolutely are always doing their own version of it. That to me is the most, you know, one of the most exciting things about Hawkwind in the 1970s is just to kind of see how they progress, but they progress in this kind of zigzag type way. It's not a linear progression ever. And certainly there's never one Hawkwind album where you put it on and you go, yeah, well, you know, pretty much all the songs sound the same. You put on a Led Zeppelin album and it might be great, but the songs are kind of all hewn from the same kind of rock, you know, and I'm a massive Sabbath fan as well, but you know, you listen to kind of something like Master of Reality and, you know, all right, it's got Solitude on it, but it's almost as though they've got the sonic template and these are all different iterations of it. And sometimes you get that with, and I suppose, Space Ritual, but most of the albums, there's so many different facets to what they're doing, you know, and this is, I guess, to do with the different personnel in the band being allowed to come through and do their own bits. But somehow, for the most part, it always hangs together as well. They produce something which is, you know, there's always a lot of good tracks on these albums, even if they're not always entirely cohesive. There's always a lot of really good tracks on the albums, right from the beginning, right through to 1979. You know, there's not a lot of bands that can say that. You know, there's a lot of bands who you think, yeah, you know, kind of these albums were great. Then they kind of dipped off a bit after that. Whereas with Hawkwind, there's always something to listen to on their albums. And you always know that you're going to come across some tracks which are really great.
It's interesting, isn't it, the different people who come into the band? Because with a lot of bands where they've had a lot of people in, it's something to kind of poke fun at because they've had a lot of bass players. But the key is that all of those bass players have been asked to play the same thing, because they need to fit the template. They need to be able to play what the guy before played so they can go live and play the old songs. Whereas you can imagine, like, Hawkwind could lose a bass player and pick up a xylophone player and not bat an eyelid. And suddenly they would be playing all the bass parts on the xylophone, and the xylophone player would write a 10-minute song on the xylophone and it would be on the album, which is unlike anything else that I know of. Bands usually have, this is the band, and if people leave, somebody else has to come in and fit in the same position as the previous person to keep that consistency. And Hawkwind just don't seem to care about that at all.
No, the fluidity is a big thing.
Yeah,
I completely agree.
That's a very interesting point. And again, I don't think it's because they naturally think, wow, it's brilliant to kind of keep on rejuvenating this by bringing in other members. They just happen across a lot of these people and you're just allowed the space to do your own thing within Hawkwind. And if kind of everybody nods their head and goes, yeah, that's pretty good, let's do it. Even though Brock is very much portrayed as this dictatorial iron fist on their musical direction, I don't think he actually is that much in the 1970s. I mean, clearly he's the main songwriter on you know, a lot of these songs, but there's such a sonic variety on these albums that if it was just kind of one iron fist vision, it would be very quickly quite redundant. I think it is that variety of sound and variety of players that is another major factor as to why those albums are so great.
Absolutely. There's a couple of things that we covered on the podcasts that were interested to know what your thought is around these, where we were picking something up and then seeing what the reasons might be behind it. And one of them goes right back to that first album, where we picked up that on the cover of that album, there is that little statement by the band saying, you know, this is the first Hawkwind album. If you're listening to this, we've already moved past this. And it felt to us very much like, in the making of the album, they'd figured out who they actually wanted to be. And who they wanted to be was the second album. And that vision came from there. Does that ring true?
You know, it's a very prophetic thing to have written. But I think that, in fairness, when the album was released, I don't think they were entirely past that sound yet. That wasn't really until the end of, say, 1970, when they started moving into much more of a rhythmic, dynamic kind of direction, that kind of trance rock, space rock kind of sound. But it has always kind of struck me as an interesting thing for any band to kind of say on its album, because it's basically kind of saying, thanks for listening, guys, but, you know, this isn't actually where we're really going. We're going somewhere else. If you just heard the album and thought, I love this album, and then you read the back, oh, we're past this now. Oh, you know, what's next? And that is really, as you say, Hawkwind's story writ large. You know, what's next? Who knows? But, you know, we're going on the trip with them.
Another thing that's happened on podcasts is that I've become so much more aware of Barney Bubbles and his impact and his artwork and his life. And really become, I think we both have probably quite big fans of Barney's work, because our discussions about the covers have been a lot more than, oh yeah, that's quite a nice cover. There's so much to take in them. Tell us a little bit about Barney Bubbles and his impact on Hawkwind. And interestingly, the thing that we kind of uncovered on the Hawklords, the 25 Years On episode, with the whole pan-transcendental industry story, which was new to me and obviously new to Matt. I only uncovered that a few hours before we recorded. How does Barney really fit into the Hawkwind picture?
And the more I keep digging, the more I appreciate how important Barney was, certainly in the early days of Hawkwind, but going forward as well, in kind of conceptualizing the band, you know, not just in the way he designed sleeves, but he worked very closely with Robert Calvert at the start, but he also worked, I think, very closely with Doug Smith as well, the kind of manager of Hawkwind. And just in terms of having some input into the direction they were going in, not necessarily musically, but it's almost like, you know, you've got people like Calvert and Bubbles, and you can see them kind of gently pushing the concept of what's Hawkwind in this direction that they want to go into. And obviously the Hawkwind log is that kind of writ large. But I think that he was clearly also a kind of a visionary designer. He was really into kind of like mysticism, philosophy, stuff like that. By the time he got to the mid-70s, he had also, you know, gone through his punk phase as well, and then goes on to become a designer for people like Stiff and a lot of iconic new wave and post-punk album covers are done by him as well. And then he is persuaded to come back and do the 25 years sleeve and the whole concept for the show, which rather controversially is somewhat mangled. And at that point, he says, that's it, I'm not having anything more to do with these guys. My favorite quote is Doug Smith, who kind of says, Hawkwind's music would not have sounded the same with anybody else's sleeves. And I think that sums it up, really.
Absolutely true. You've definitely looked and found things in the covers that even I've been looking at those covers for 25 years and I hadn't seen them.
I've enjoyed the covers for sure. I didn't think they were going to become a big part of the podcast, but certainly we've spent some good times going in them, and they're always different. Like the 25 years one, was not expecting it.
Particularly, I suppose, when you look at the 25 years cover and you look at the Space Ritual cover and you go, that's the same guy. They're only about 5 years apart. If they were like 20 years apart, you would think, yeah, people go through different parts of their lives, but they're practically next to each other.
Sorry, I just interpreted that as that you were saying that the interpretation of Stacia on the front of Space Ritual is the same guy who's on 25 years. But I actually really like that because I have to say that when I first saw the sleeve of Space Ritual, I almost thought it was like a hermaphrodite kind of figure. It certainly doesn't look that much like Stacia. But I liked, actually, when you were talking about 25 years on, because I talked about the whole Robert Mapplethorpe imagery aspect of it. But I like the fact that you just saw the guy as like this stripped down quasi-industrial worker of the future. But I like the comparison that Space Ritual and Hawklords, they're both figurative covers. They have figures on the front, however different those figures are. But I appreciate what you're saying, that Bubbles was just racing ahead of the pack. He really was. You know, you speak to all kinds of designers and stuff like that, and they hold him in very, very high regard even today.
I'd love to read a biography of his.
Well, there is. There's a guy called Paul Gorman wrote Reasons to be Cheerful, which is like a big biography come book of all of Barney's designs, which I think is out of print and is probably going for a lot of money these days. But if you can get hold of that, that's really worth reading.
Another thing, Joe, is that Charisma era, Dave and Bob kind of win their little tug of war for control of the band, if you like, from Astounding Sounds, and they produce Quark, which is a brilliant, brilliant album. Massive transition, hugely popular. I mean, it's by some way the most downloaded of our podcast episodes, so even today. And it strikes me at that point that they're aligned. They're all pointing in the same direction, like all of them. And they should be destined to become like a major force in that kind of new wave era. And then they really make a massive pig's ear of it, don't they?
Yeah. I think the problem is that, you know, both the kind of blessing and the curse of having Robert Calvert as your creative genius within the band, you know, the person who's like your real ideas and concepts man, is that he is an unstable character. He's kind of struggling all the time with kind of mental health issues, a lot of which were probably not particularly well understood in 1977. And when he goes off the rails, which he does in a tour of France in October 1977, then, like you say, they were all pointing in the same direction. They were very together. They were focused. And that's why it's such an amazing album. But I think as soon as Calvert becomes defocused and all of the stuff that then happens, leaving him running down the middle of a street in Paris as they speed off to the airport in a car, is just, you know, then you just know kind of it's gone wrong at that point and there's not really much coming back from it. Although they did come back from it. They still went then and recorded PXR5 the following January. I don't think it's as good as Quark, but it's a great album anyway. But, you know, kind of Calvert is clearly on a bit of a downward arc at this point. And they do this kind of tour of America in 1978, which is a, you know, they haven't been there for kind of 3 years or so. And it just seems to be the straw that breaks the camel's back. It's kind of not particularly well organized. They're playing quite small venues. Calvert is very, very subdued. Simon House has left the band to go and join David Bowie's group. It's just when a group of people, I guess, get into that kind of spiral, it's just like, I just don't want to go on with this anymore. Hawkwind, one of these bands that didn't ever have a big machine behind them, kind of saying, come on, guys, we need to do this, we need to do this. That's the only problem with being outside of the music industry as much as they were. It meant that there wasn't a great support mechanism in place for them when things went wrong. And I think that's a very good illustration of it.
That's an excellent point. You need that strategist behind the scenes, the Brian Epstein or the guy who kind of pushed Genesis through. You need someone outside of the band masterminding, the Peter Grant. You need those characters, and Hawkwind didn't really have them.
Well, I mean, they had had Doug Smith in the early days, and that is partly why they were so successful. You know, going up to that period, 72, 75, Doug Smith, their manager, what he did for them can't be underestimated. But by the time they got to Charisma, they were working with Tony Howard and Jeff Dexter. And, you know, they weren't kind of particularly great believers in Hawkwind. They just thought that they would be a good band to work with. And as it was, I don't think they found it very easy working with them at all. Hawkwind didn't find it very easy working with them. And, you know, at the very least, you've got to have a strong manager. But I'm guessing I'm talking about all of the other support mechanism that surround bands these days. Whereas the 1977, you're still being sent off in a transit van or maybe kind of like a half-decent bus. But, you know, you're still fending for yourself to a certain extent, you know. And, you know, when you've got somebody like Calvert in the band freaking out, it's like, oh, my God, what do we do? For that period of time anyway, that was what did for them. But, you know, they bounce back, you know, as they always did.
As they do. So, actually, coming to the last section of today's rather epic show, as you've led into it beautifully there, because although it's released, I believe, in 1980, Live 79 is the final statement from Hawkwind in the 1970s. And it's an interesting one because of it, obviously, it's a very strong signal as to, you know, what is about to follow in this Hawkwind mark, whatever mark it would happen to be at this point. There's too many marks. So how do they go from effectively being finished at the end of 25 years, really, because, of course, PXR5 was recorded sometime before, to Dave putting this interesting little hodgepodge Hawkwind superstars lineup together to go on a tour to support nothing?
Yeah, so at the start of 1979, as I say, Calvert's left and Martin Griffin, the Hawkwind drummer, has left. And they're kind of at Rockfield, kind of trying to work out what they're going to do next. And they make a series of demos, which we've talked about, Valium 10, Who's Going to Win the War. And I think around the time of PXR5 coming out, which is, I think, June 79, that spurs them back into action. They think, look, you know, if we're going to do anything, we've got to turn back into Hawkwind. We'll stop being the Hawklords. We've got to return to Hawkwind. But Steve Swindles had left as well. So it's basically just a trio of Brock, Harvey Bainbridge and Simon King at this point. So they think, right, we need to kind of like get some more instrumentalists back into the band. So the first thing they do is they tap up Tim Blake, who they had known from the early days back in Notting Hill, but he had left to go and live in France and he then joins Gong. And he had just played the 1979 Glastonbury Festival. He'd actually been the last act and had, you know, gone down well. But he was kind of having a bit of a personal crisis at the time and didn't really want to be on his own anymore. And so when he got the phone call from, I think Doug Smith probably kind of rang him up because Doug Smith was back managing them again now, and said, you know, Tim, do you fancy joining Hawkwind? He kind of said, yeah, great. So they had him on board. And then Simon King, kind of when they decided, why don't we get another guitar player? Simon King, who'd been working with Hugh Lloyd Langdon, who had been the original guitarist on their very first album, said, you know, Hugh, do you want to get back together? And yes. So then you've got now this band, you've lost the kind of conceptual kind of wordsmith that's Calvert, the kind of intellectual part of Hawkwind, but what you've got instead is this instrumental firepower in his place. And so then the sound changes again quite a lot to be, you know, based around the guitar of Lloyd Langdon and Blake's keyboards in particular. And as you say, they're without a record contract at this point, although it is mooted that they're meant to be signing to a label called Automatic, who are a subsidiary of Warner Brothers. And that's kind of happening, which is why when they do the Live 79 tour, which is kind of variously promoted as the Masters of the Universe tour or the 10th anniversary tour, and it's entirely self-funded, but this is why they're supported by a band called Doll by Doll, who happen to be an Automatic band. And, you know, it's a bit of a gamble doing this, but the fact is even though Hawkwind have been pretty much out of the limelight for all of 1979, they have such a big fan base that they organise this tour, and it's proper concert halls. It's Hammersmith Odeon style kind of halls, and all but four of the gigs sell out. And so there starts the next chapter of Hawkwind, this band which are now, as I would probably call them, a kind of cosmic metal band, if you like. You know, they're very much going now, almost kind of again, scenting in the air what's coming with things like the new wave of British heavy metal. They kind of run with that for a couple of years. You know, they can tell that kind of things are changing. The set becomes a lot more bombastic. It's not as subtle. It's certainly, like I say, you don't have somebody like Calvert there as a kind of front man. It's much more about the music again. But yeah, it's the next chapter in Hawkwind. And there's an interview with Dave Brock at the time. And by this point, you know, the press are talking to kind of Hawkwind and, you know, oh my God, this band have been going for 10 years, you know, kind of ancient veterans. How on earth have they managed to keep it together this long? And the journalist is amazed that they're still able to sell out these venues kind of after all this time. And Brock says, the one thing that people don't understand about this band and have never understood about this band, that it is about constant change. It's a radical band, you know. A lot of other bands, you know, they find their niche, they find their groove, they get into it, they dig down, you know, for all it's worth. And Hawkwind are not like that. And this kind of next phase of the band, who then go on to record the Levitation album, absolutely prove that.
Absolutely. It's interesting getting Hugh back. I remember reading a quote, I think, from Lemmy, who said that Hugh took 10 tabs of acid and then disappeared for a decade, or some words to that effect. But he's back. He's a major, major figure in Hawkwind going forward. They end up on Bronze. I mentioned this to you off air. There's a quote on Wikipedia, which is obviously the ultimate in trustworthy news sources. But Jerry Bronn, who is the head of Bronze Records, said, "I don't think we would have signed Hawkwind if it weren't for Motorhead. I can't say I was that interested." So it sounds like they kind of ended up with the 2-album Bronze deal as some kind of a favour to Lemmy.
I think it was more a favour to Doug Smith, because Doug Smith was also the manager of Motorhead. And right. So they had recorded one of the shows on this 10th anniversary tour at the end of 1979. And basically, you know, Doug Smith goes to him and says, "Look, you know, we've got this recording of the show. What do you think?" He obviously already has a relationship with Jerry Bronn because of Motorhead, and Motorhead are at this point just about to break very, very big indeed. So Hawkwind were a pretty big band still, a pretty big name. So, you know, if it had been an unknown, he would have probably said, you know, forget it. But as it was, it's a reasonable investment. It's a live album, you know, it hasn't cost anything for anybody to record. So, you know, it was probably a pretty easy decision to make. But you're right. I mean, it probably just was because of Doug Smith's connection with the label via Motorhead. I don't think he tried shopping it around any other labels.
And it actually gets to number 15 in the album charts, which is astonishing. They haven't been that far up the charts since Warrior on the Edge of Time. And of course, the single as a moderate success as well.
Yeah, so Shot Down in the Night, which is this song that Steve Swindles leaves behind and ironically releases his own version of that song on the very day that the Hawkwind version is released. But Hawkwind get into the charts and Steve unfortunately doesn't. But yeah, it is a bit of a mystery, because people look back now on the Charisma period and the Robert Calvert period and go, oh my God, these albums are amazing and Calvert is such an artist, blah, blah, blah. But the fact remains that they weren't that popular at the time compared to, you know, kind of the early albums. Now, obviously, you know, chart placing isn't everything, but it's got to mean something. And I think that Charisma probably didn't promote them as well as they could have done. But it wasn't as though they weren't putting plenty of ads on them in the papers and all the rest of it. And so, yeah, I mean, Live 79 getting to 15 is really interesting. I think that probably a lot of people reacted really well to that tour. Another thing that's interesting to mention, of course, is that, and again, this came up in the article I mentioned where Brock is quoted, is that their audience is very, very young still. You know, their audience is still mostly made up of teenagers. I think Bronze kind of apparently were quite canny in the way that they released it. They were a very clever record label in terms of how they promoted their artists. But still, yeah, it's an amazing achievement. But it is almost like a kind of judgment on the charisma years. It's like, thanks, you know, actually we like this stuff better when Hawkwind are really going for it 100 miles an hour space rock.
Yeah, and Matt, this is a different sound. And if we're looking at Live 79 as almost the post-credits scene of a Marvel movie that kind of leads into the 1980s and season two and Levitation, you've heard Live 79. What did you make of it musically?
The last live album that I really got my teeth into was Space Ritual. But this one sounded more like what I thought Space Ritual was. You can hear the crowd. There's a bit more banter. There's breaks in the tracks, which then go into new tracks. It feels more like a gig where you feel like Space Ritual feels more like some kind of like weird art that you stumbled into, more of a performance, I guess, where this one feels much more like a gig. But I enjoy the energy of this. Again, I kind of feel like I wanted more of it. I feel like a lot of people must have bought this album before they heard the end for it to get to 15 in the charts. Because again, I feel like that idea of you can never be sure of what Hawkwind are going to do. It took to the last 10 seconds of this album before they pulled a very Hawkwind maneuver and just decided to blow up the album halfway through a track, which is like a crowd favorite, which makes me feel like, again, Hawkwind seemed to be deliberately going against things which would do them well, like playing a hit. Brock trolls the audience by saying like, oh yeah, we'll play that Washing Machine track instead of Silver Machine, you know, to have a joke with them. And then they go into it and then you're like, okay, they're going to do it. And then it cuts.
Are they just sick of it by now, John?
It's funny, actually, because ironically, it sounds like it's actually going to be a terrific version. I mean, it sounds really, really good. The sound they've got on Live 79 really suits the track. And they had stopped playing Silver Machine for quite a while, but I think actually they had resurrected it on the Hawklords tour in 78 and had continued playing it. But it does seem a very perverse gesture because, you know, it sounds like it's actually going to be a really, really good version. And actually, what I find quite weird is it's obviously been re-released and been given the whole Atom Henge treatment. But the original tapes, I don't know, where are they? They can't exist anymore because you would have thought at the very least they go, oh, here's the version where it doesn't explode. No, there is no version out there where it doesn't explode. This is it. And it's another piece of bizarre self-sabotage in a way, because in a way, you know, they're trying to say, we're past this now, you know, we're not doing this anymore. Although obviously the album has Brainstorm and Master of the Universe on it, you know, which was still going strong at that point.
And they clearly did it because there's a tape of it. I guess they just decided they didn't want to have it on the album, but they still put it on the album enough to get rid of it, which, again, yeah, for me seems a very strange thing. Also, like you said, because they took such a long time to try and find someone who could sing it, then they found Lemmy. And when I heard they were going to do this live, it's like, oh, let's see how Brock does it. And it sounds like Brock's actually going to nail it. And then it just blows up, which, again, has the same effect as the motor off for me for Paranoia. We're like, oh, Hawkwind. You can never produce an album which I can like 100% of. It seems to be like a pathological inability to just make an album that makes sense. They have to do something very weird, and I guess they do that.
You mentioned, Joe, that obviously Master of the Universe and Brainstorm are both on this album. And it struck me when I was listening to it, again, having heard the 70s albums like in a row, is that this is the birth of the more muscular, guitar-driven, heavy versions of both of those songs that has remained consistent, really, to this day.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, they're kind of both songs which are based around great riffs. They're kind of unkillable in a way, you know, that you play the riff, you've got the song. But one of the things I was slightly surprised at in terms of reactions to the book, that I didn't get more flack for what I had written about Live 79, because I have to say that, you know, I'm not a massive fan of the album. I think it's kind of interesting. I like the version of Spirit of the Age on it, actually. I think that's quite fun. But it has Lighthouse, which is a track I absolutely hate. It's a Tim Blake song, so it's not really a Hawkwind song, but I think I'd describe that as the low point in Hawkwind's recorded output of the period. So it's a funny album. As I said, clearly kind of very popular at the time. And a lot of people, you know, clearly this is the direction they wanted Hawkwind to go back into. And fair enough. We talked about Valium 10 as being, you know, if Steve Swindles had stayed on, maybe could you imagine them kind of doing more of that stuff? Would that have taken them into the 80s? I don't know. They probably made the right decision, actually. I mean, as you'll hear, Matt, when you hear Levitation, I think, you'll hear that straight away, here is a band which sounds very much like it's in the 1980s, you know?
Yeah, very much so. Interesting on Lighthouse, Matt, because funny enough, when I heard it, I thought that Lighthouse might be a track that you might gravitate towards.
I didn't mind it, for sure. I don't hate it. What with everything we were trying to do with this and also trying to edit the PXR5, I don't feel like I listened to it enough to feel like I'm an authority on it at all. But I thought they were trying to do some kind of thing where they were trying to like make a parity between a Lighthouse and like a Polestar or something, because you'd have that idea about guiding light, about lights in darkness and stuff. And it took me a while to realize that they were talking about a Lighthouse, because I don't think I saw the track listing before. I must admit, though, that I didn't like the Spirit of the Age version on this one. I thought the speed of it and asking a question changed it to me. Like, is this the Spirit of the Age? Is weird, because I always think, no, it's not. You've made all this up. So, no. You know, I actually find them saying that's the Spirit of the Age an annoying thing to say anyway, because I think we said this before, we kind of like, that's still that kind of shrug, like, what are you going to do? It's like, but if it's a story and you say that, it's weird because you made them be in that situation. So to make that situation then shrug about it feels weird. It feels more of a thing you do to real life, which is, you know, fine, you can do that. But to ask, is this the Spirit of the Age, was an odd change for that.
Interestingly, the studio version on Quark, obviously we discussed it at great length, and that track is all about the words and Calvert's delivery of the words. And it's just got this musical background. Somebody had said, you know, it's a very simple, there's only two chords in it, which is perfectly fine for it to have two chords in it, but the music is not front and center. It's the words and the poetry and those magnificent lines, you know, over the wings of any bird other than a battery hen. It just, like, you get shivers. When Brock does it on Live 79, he doesn't have the Calvert delivery of those words. He's more singing them like lines of a song. They lack the profundity. But the music that's backing him up is better than the backing music to Calvert on the studio track. So it's almost that the whole thing has flipped. It's now a musical song rather than a poem. And I like both versions. I think I can see certainly that you just can't do the Calvert version without Calvert. You have to adapt it. So it's the song adapted for a new Hawkwind and a new age and a different vocalist. I like it. I think it works. It will never quite replace the studio version. You know, those words just really grab me every time. Recently, they did it on the Palladium show that I went to a couple of months ago, and it still really works. So, yeah. An interesting album, a bit of a teaser for you, Matt, that takes us into the 1980s.
Which I feel like, considering the end on an explosion, literally anything could come out the other side of that. Like, as we said before, so, you know, if you're going to completely start over again, why not blow up everything that you've made and see what happens? As you said before, in the
Children of the Sun,
you know, people scraping around the dust of a fallen civilization, trying to find whatever they can do. I feel like we are now potentially scrabbling around in the dust of an exploded heritage of the 70s. And now we'll see what we can do with whatever remains of Hawkwind.
It will be an interesting episode one of season two when we get around to that one at some point in the new year. Joe, what do we see you doing next?
I said to Mark at Stranger Tractor once when we'd finished this book, he said, oh, what are you doing next? I said, I'm not writing another book ever again. That's it. And of course, now I'm kind of thinking seriously, as it were, about, you know, because you go through all of these different stages of kind of thinking a bit about something and then thinking a bit more. Then you find you're doing some research and then you're really seriously thinking about doing something. And I'm kind of at that level now with another book. And world exclusive, I think I'm going to write a book about Peter Hamill.
Wow. There you go. You heard it here first, people. And obviously, despite the fact that post-Levitation, there won't be any more readings from your wonderful book, hopefully, you know, Hawkwind are still making new music. Seemingly, they are unstoppable at this point. You would always be welcome to join us on the Hawk Binge podcast.
Thank you. Well, I do have a lot of affection for particularly the early 80s albums, because as I said, that was when I was first getting into Hawkwind. And I think in particular, Choose Your Masks is an absolutely magnificent and much underrated album. I don't want to give you too many spoilers though, Matt, but you've still got a lot of interesting stuff ahead of you.
Which I'm very glad about. Yeah, the fact that we've been charting these and there's still plenty of gaps in the high teens and I think even like the high tens, which is good. Because I was hating when we were going to be like, first album gets one, second album gets two, second album gets three, like, oh no, we're just in this kind of diminishing returns. But that has not actually been the case. So this is good. Again, another one of the things about Hawkwind where I can never quite predict. So yeah, looking forward to the next load.
I have to say, I was outraged when you read how low down Hawklords was in Elton Newby's book. Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Lemmy's calling time on us.
It wouldn't be a Joe Banks guest appearance without Lemmy.
Oh, you silly dog. Shush.
Yeah, I was surprised about that as well. I thought
yeah, lots of people were.
That.
It was obviously, it's net 16 if you take out the live albums.
Yeah, I was expecting it to be more.
I think it's probably my favourite album of the Calvert period, even more so than Quark. I think it's just brilliant. Even with Flying Doctor on it, I think it's just brilliant. I think the first side is absolutely magnificent. I absolutely love that. But interesting, you know, it was their lowest charting album by a long chalk, kind of in the 70s as well. And I don't know, there's still... I don't know what it is. It's there's obviously kind of some residual bad feeling towards it. Or maybe people, you know, other people kind of like the other stuff better, you know. It's just as simple as that. But yeah, I don't know. I do find it quite surprising. I mean, I mean, Psy Power for me is probably the best song that Hawkwind ever wrote. You know, I might say something like, you know, Born to Go from Space Ritual is the ultimate Hawkwind song, or You Shouldn't Do That. But I think Psy Power is the best song they ever wrote, personally.
I would love to see it back in the live set. It would so work with the way they play now as well. So yeah, and I'm absolutely with you on that one.
One of
absolutely.
The best opening tracks as well. Like yeah. We've always I feel like I've always suffered from Hawkwind having suboptimal opening tracks, but Psy Power, the very first time I heard that, I was like, oh no, I like this. This is cool.
Yeah, very much. A great live version on This Is Hawkwind, Do Not Panic as well. So yeah, brilliant. Well look, Joe, we have kept you a long, long time on this episode, but it's been awesome just to chat Hawkwind and go through those bonus tracks and exercise your right of reply to Matt's previously more critiqued tracks. And it's just great to talk about this rather fascinating, crazy, anarchic band with someone who knows and cares so much about them.
Thank you. Well, it's been great fun. And as you say, there's always plenty to talk about with Hawkwind. You'll never run out of things to say.
Yeah, that's totally true.
And Joe, if people do want to keep in touch with you on the socials and such like, how can people do that?
Well, I would love people to come and follow me on Twitter. I am Joe Banks Writer on Twitter. I am going to change my tagline, I think, to Classic Hawkwind Trivia Node, seeing as that's basically what the Twitter feed has turned into. But of course, it's now going to turn into Peter Hamill Trivia over the next few months, I would say. But please do follow me there. But I would absolutely encourage people to go and visit the website if they haven't, daysoftheunderground.com, because that is absolutely, as I said, a companion to the book. It's not just a promo for it. There's a section on there called Addendum Infinitum, which is where I put in all of the stuff I've learned since I wrote the book, and has got a few corrections in there as well. And that's currently at 16,000 words. So if you want to kind of read more stuff like Days of the Underground, please do go to the website. It's got loads of stuff, all of the Hawkwind films, documentaries collected there, all kinds of stuff. So you can waste a day there.
Many days, in fact. I've been there and there's some outstanding things on there. Totally a vault to get lost in. And Matt, where can people find us?
Well, you can find us at Hawkbinge on all your favourite socials, which are Instagram and Twitter. And if Facebook is something that you like, then we have started to repackage all of our stuff onto Facebook because they now have dedicated podcast pages. So we've made one of those. If you look for Hawkbinge on Facebook, you can find our podcast and any other information that we have, all our links, all our stories, all our pictures, our scans of the books and other travel documents that we have encountered during the whole thing. Probably going to try and do that over the new year break. So if you wait patiently, I will get all that up. And if you want to send us anything in our little hiatus that's more long form, you can find us on email, which is podcast at hawk.com. binge.space. And I'm pretty sure that's everywhere, apart from, of course, YouTube, where I put up all the podcasts in a more audiovisual kind of way. Any images or album artwork or anything that we find interesting, I throw up on screen as well. So if you like to follow this with a little bit more extra media, then you can follow us there. Again, we don't have our vanity URL yet, but if you like and subscribe to us on YouTube, we need 100 followers in order to get an actual URL. I think we have like 70 odd now, so we're getting close. But if you search Hawk Binge into YouTube, again, we're pretty much the only thing that comes up.
Happy days. And so it only really remains to wish everybody out there, you Hawk Bingers and Matt and Joe, a very happy Christmas and a wonderful new year. I hope you have one if this comes out before. I hope you had one if this comes out afterwards. And we will see you again for season two of Hawk Binge.
So when do you think season two is going to start, Andy?
Well, I think...